And checking in with the felt sense, the felt experience of this moment. These conversations are disturbing and can trigger feelings, so just to see what's there right now. And letting the breath soften the body, soften the heart. We connect with the breath as a way of focusing the mind. A very simple way of being present. Just feeling the air at the nostrils or the movement of the belly. Or just the whole of the breath. And as we come in close to the breath, as we connect and feel the details of the sensations that get very intimate with the breath. This helps us to cut off the stream of thought or interrupt the stream of thought. This form of practice is meant to help us to step out of the complications of mind into a very simple engagement with the present moment, through the breath. We can see or feel or sense the way the mind wants to keep spinning. It's got this momentum, this habit of movement, of churning through thoughts and ideas, fears, plans, memories. Now there can be a resistance to the simplicity of breath. The mind wants more, or it just is habituated to more complications. We have to teach ourselves to appreciate the quiet. Like appreciating sobriety. When you've been used to the exhilaration of intoxication, The practice of insight meditation suggests that there is a deeper knowing, a deeper wisdom than that which the typical movements of mind can offer. And to come to this knowing and wisdom, we first must make some space. So, because of the mind is so busy in its ordinary behavior, we might find that much of our work is just trying to create that space. And the insight that this practice points to is not personal or psychological, but the universal insight into impermanence, to suffering and the lack of a solid self, an unchanging self. These insights are not ideas or thoughts that arise, but rather felt experiences. If we go chasing after them, the very chasing tends to close the door to wisdom. As the chasing is just another form of grasping. So the practice once again comes back to letting go. So coming to the end of step seven, then, amazingly enough, it's been a long time. So I'm at this really funny little place. So for anybody who might be joining us for the first time, we've been going through my book, One Breath at a Time, Buddhism and the 12 Steps. And as I said, we're in step seven. Step seven says, we humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings, which is the him being God. And so, from a Buddhist viewpoint, we look at this as the process of letting go of the things that cause suffering. And one of the, things about Buddhism, of course, is that that's kind of what it's all about. So for people who have been addicted or caught up in, habitual destructive behavior, any kind of program or recovery program, of course, is about changing that, about letting go. And the beauty of the Buddhism is that that's at its core what it's about, is about letting go of the causes of suffering. And that involves, first of all, seeing what those causes are, and really, in terms of what we're really talking about here is the Four Noble Truths, which the first one is just seeing the suffering itself, which is also, a significant part of a recovery process, because the first thing we have to do is really acknowledge the problem. And that can be sometimes the most difficult part, certainly one of the difficult parts of dealing with our addiction, is just seeing it as a problem, rather than blaming other people or situations or thinking that we're under control. So that acknowledgement of the problem, which is kind of step one in the 12 steps, the admitting we're powerless over alcohol or drugs or gambling or food, that our lives become unmanageable. That's really kind of the first noble truth, seeing the suffering. And it implies as well the second noble truth, that is, we realize that the suffering is caused by the clinging. So this is the really elegant way that that Buddhism addresses addiction in a very organic way, the way that wasn't initially designed specifically as being about addiction. Vimalasara says, that Buddhism is the original recovery program. So in step seven, we're really explicitly engaging in that letting go, and which is why I spend a lot of time with step seven, because it seems like step six, which is the getting ready, and then step seven are really at the heart of that letting go process. And it's always been a question for me ever since I started working the steps, and particularly when I worked step six and seven, how that was supposed to work. And, I was even at that stage of recovery when I worked step six and seven, which was when I was a little over a year sober, I was really skeptical of what was sort of offered in the literature, just sort of saying this prayer. You kind of share your inventory and then you go home and look at the steps, and then you say a prayer, and then it's not that you're done, but that's supposed to sort of initiate at least this process. And so a lot of my own work around this letting go has been coming to understand the tools of Buddhism and how they operated and how they facilitate this change and this transformation, this letting go. And, you know, and that comes down to essentially karma, the law of karma, that actions have results. And this is one way that Buddhism really offers a different view of what recovery is about, where the 12 steps say that it's God removing our defects. Buddhism looks at it in much more dry and practical terms. Although I think, you know, so and that just through the three forms of action, changing thoughts, changing words, changing deeds, that then is what brings about change. And certainly it's not unreasonable to kind of correlate the law of karma with the idea of God. If when we look at the Abrahamic religions, they, you know, the guidelines, the rules, the commandments are really about changing karma, ultimately. Even the idea of sin can be kind of correlated with negative karma. If I get myself to this little, I think this might be the shortest little section of the book. It's really just over a page long, called The Three P's. And this is something that came from my sponsor and just sort of one of those funny things that found its way into the book. But it is here at this particular point for a reason, because the section before it is about the tendency to go to extremes. And the two sections, there's the section that's about renunciation called A Dirty Word, and then the section called Don't Overdo It, which is about not sort of going to extremes in renunciation and trying to find a middle way, which is, you know, forever a challenge. But then this thing, the three P's start with perfectionism, and perfectionism being one of the extremes. This little opening, one of the extremes that alcoholics and addicts often act out is perfectionism. Oddly enough, many sloppy drunks discover in sobriety this quality in themselves. People who have lived risky, careless lives realize that many of their destructive and irresponsible actions were perverse expressions of their wish to get things right. Exactly right. So, you know, this idea that you know, we get sober and all of a sudden we're trying to be the perfect sober person, you know, like we really weren't worried about too much before, you know, we're kind of, you know, letting a lot of things slip, and all of a sudden we have to get it exactly right. And so my sponsor gave me this formula that perfectionism leads to procrastination, because it's like, well, if I can't do it perfectly well, I'm not going to do it at all. And then the third P is paralysis, so that we just don't do anything. And you know, I don't know that it's true for every person in recovery or every addict, but it was something that I ran into, you know, and started to see how that was getting in my way. You know, and when we come to meditation, we can do the same thing, you know, where we're striving for some ideal. You know, in my own practice, I think when I started out, I was striving for an ideal, but I didn't know what the ideal was. Which really, that's really a problem. And I've got to do this right, but what does that mean? And you know, and of course, in the beginning, it's just this sort of simplistic idea that getting it right is not thinking. If I can stop my thinking, which is, you know, the most common problem misunderstanding about meditation, the idea that stopping our thinking is what we're supposed to do, and that when we accomplish that, will then be doing it right. Which even in itself is interesting, the idea that we're meditating not to get some benefit from it, but we're just trying to do it right. You know, we're just trying to get good at meditating. You know, it's being good at meditating doesn't prove anything. That doesn't, you know, I got good at meditating before I was sober, you know, just because I did it a lot. But nothing much changed in my life, you know. I could have nice periods of quiet. That was about the only thing that changed. So, you know, this is why we have to see beyond these kind of limited ideas of what meditation is. And then, you know, perhaps we figure out, oh, well, as I was sort of saying in the guided meditation today, well, then we realize, oh, it's not about just stopping thinking. It's about having these insights. Okay, now I have to get them. And, you know, again, we turn our practice into a kind of acquisition, you know. And it's this, you know, this what Trungpa called spiritual materialism, you know. I mean, I have sat around with people debating what the jhanas are and, you know, really like what's behind that is, oh no, I was in this jhana. No, well, I was in this jhana, you know, and the jhanas are these like concentration states and they're just like, who cares? Like it's nothing. And once again, you know, since this sort of whole thing comes around to the question of middle way, what I think is difficult is when we let go of perfectionism, what's enough? What's good enough? You know, the phrase "doing your best," I think is just really like confusing. Like I'm always like, what is my best? And so we can, that then comes back again to the question of right effort, which is another theme that, you know, I return to over and over. Because just, you know, not much happens in meditation if you don't do something, you know. So what is that effort? You know, what's enough effort? What's right effort? So, you know, my sort of take on this starts with showing up. And this is, you know, many times, excuse me, when I've been asked to speak in a meeting and asked for a topic, after I speak, you know, the topic I offer is showing up. Because to me, that's the foundation of recovery. not you know, getting it right, or everything is going perfectly in your life, or all your relationships are perfect, or your job is great. It's like, no, I didn't drink or use today, and I showed up. And to me, showing up with, as an addict and as an alcoholic, implies not drinking or using, because I'm like, that's the bottom line, right? It's the showing up for my recovery is to not drink or use first. And then, of course, when, you know, with meetings and, you know, here you guys all are, and you're showing up, you know, I don't know how your meditation was today. I'm not going to grade your meditation. You know, if you go on a retreat, you know, what people are going to ask you, like people who know anything about meditation, what they're going to ask is not tell me like how many times your mind wandered. They're going to say, how long was the retreat? Because the time, the showing up for that many days is what really does. Is that the foundation of the work? When people say, Oh, you're in recovery. What's the question they ask? How long have you been sober, right? That's what we define as success, not how's your sobriety been? You know, tell me, have you ever gotten angry while you've been sober? Did you ever lose a job? Did you ever break up a relationship? No, that's not like how we define success in recovery. It's just that you keep it going. And so to me, that's why daily practice and just showing up for our meditation is so important. The wisdom comes if we're showing up in for our meditation, stuff happens, and I think we want to control it, and we want to be the ones who define what it's going to be and what it's going to look like and how it's, you know, when it's going to come, and all this stuff about our spiritual development. We have no control over any of that stuff. The only thing we have control over is showing up. And, you know, we have to learn to just trust that process. And you know, I think some people can make more effort than others. Some people will tend to get more insight than others. Some people will develop more concentration or less concentration. And I'm not sure how much control, actual control, we have on those things. So a little bit more about effort. I think when I was doing some of my retreats where it was in some deeper concentration states, I started to notice that as I got more concentrated, I could make more effort without it turning into a struggle. And this is, of course, the problem with striving, that a striving effort. Most of the time, if you're in just sort of an ordinary mind state, you sit down to meditate and you really kind of try to force something to happen, it just gets worse, you know. You feel just more tense and you feel more frustrated, and you know. But I found that, you know, a couple of weeks into a silent retreat, I was able to really push, but it wasn't creating stress. And how I came to understand that, and this might be true, I think this is a good explanation of that, though, is that as the quiet and the concentration developed, there was less ego. That the effort wasn't driven by grasping. It was actually right effort. It was guided by right intention. And that as we meditate, and you see this, the longer you meditate, the quieter the ego gets. There's less desire, there's less craving. And so it made me kind of go back and look at the way the Buddha talks about right effort. And I've come to believe, as the saying goes, that when the Buddha was talking about right effort, and he talks about four elements of right effort, avoiding the negative, destructive mind states, abandoning ones that have arisen, cultivating the positive mind states, maintaining the positive mind states, that when he was talking about that, he was talking about it in the context of someone who was already kind of concentrated. That he really wasn't talking to us. He wasn't really talking to us ordinary, as he would say, unenlightened worldlings, you know, lay people who are meditating for 20 minutes each day. He was talking to monks who were like devoted and were practicing, you know, and done lots and lots of practice and silent retreat, at least what we would call retreat. We don't see that word in the suttas, but and so it made me think, okay, that's great for when I'm in that state, but I have to think about right effort in a different way when I'm not in those states, in the already concentrated state. And this is where, you know, this much more gentle and, you know, it's almost like, it's really kind of paradoxical that when we're not concentrated, we have to make less effort. That is really confusing. What do you mean? This is when I need to make more effort. No, but you can't do it. You know, it's more surrender. It's more an acceptance. Those are the things that we're cultivating when we're less concentrated. Just, okay, just sit, just keep sitting. You know, sit through the restlessness, sit through the sleepiness, sit through the resistance. Just sit with it, just accept and be with it. Any striving that you do, any force that you apply is going to wind up, you know, redounding back on you, or rebounding back on you. So just as with perfectionism, to bring it back to where we were in the book, you know, we have to find another way. And this is so tricky for us as alcoholics, because what, you know, we're all about going to extremes. I think that, you know, when you get sober, you get clean, when you come into recovery, certainly in the beginning, there's a sense that you can't trust your own judgment. And certainly a sponsor of a newcomer will emphasize that point. Like, you cannot trust your own judgment. Yeah, that's why I'm here, to help you make better decisions. So with meditation, there's no sponsor in there, you know, to help to guide you in your meditation. You have to trust your own judgment, and you have to, that's why you study with the teacher. But nonetheless, during those quiet moments, you still have to sort of figure out, how do I respond to this? How do I get through this? How do I keep sitting here? What do I need to do? What's the effort I need to make? And, you know, that's the work. And that's the great challenge of practice, is to learn to trust yourself, and to navigate your way through that, you know, confusing maze of mind and body that's just so full of noise and agitation, and, you know, and find a way to just sit with it. So there you go. That's what I can say for you this morning. Hope that's of some help. I can hear in my voice, you know, a certain something, emotion, you know, just uncomfortable emotion. And, you know, I was reading yesterday this beautiful book called You Belong by Sebane Selassie. And she was talking about how we identify, how we basically, kind of how we name our emotions, and how that's actually culturally created. And that is absolutely true in my experience. And when we name an emotion something, it takes on a solidity that if we're just with it as a felt experience, it doesn't necessarily have. So I'm not naming what I'm feeling right now. I'm just feeling it. So just to like open it up, we have some time. If there are questions or comments.
I have a question.
Oh, man, wonderful.
Yeah. Hi.
Hi.
Good morning. Yeah, I feel it too. Whatever that is. I was listening to a talk the other day by Jack Kornfield, an old one. And he was talking about the Sure Hearts release. And then I read something that there's a sutta about it or something, mm-hmm. the Sure Hearts release, that yeah. the goal of the holy life is not to reach great insights and concentration, or, you know, it's not about status or any of that. It's about the Sure Hearts release. And I was just wondering if you could, I'm not really quite sure what that means exactly, but it intrigues me. And I, yeah.
Yeah, that is a very Jack, you know, phrase that I don't really, I can't do very much with it. It's kind of not really in my wheelhouse.
Is that his phrase?
Well, no, I think you're right that there is a sutta that's a translation of it. I've seen that. I'm not sure. It doesn't sound like the Pali Canon, you know. because I think I do think I've seen it somewhere in a sutta, but what I mean is it's very much like in tune with how Jack transmits Dharma, you know, and it's not quite, it's just not language that quite. It's a confusing term to me. Yeah. I'm not sure. I don't quite understand what the word sure means in that sentence. And then heart's release is just sort of awfully vague. It's great, you know, it sounds great.
Is it just letting go? I mean, just...
I guess, yeah.
Letting go into the facts of, you know, impermanence, and there is no solid sense.
That sounds good.
Just letting go.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
Well, you know, I'm not being much help for you, Anne. I'm sorry.
Well, I'll find the sutta maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That'd be a good idea.
Yeah.
Do it. Look at it in the sutta study class.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, don't mention the sutta study class.
Michelle has her hand up.
Oh, okay. Well,
go ahead.
Michelle, go for it.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
I'm so happy to be here. I've been coming and following you for a few months now, you know, on Friday nights often, and for a few months now. So I'm so grateful. So this three P's, oh my gosh. It just really is, I find it just so annoying because it's exactly me. Yeah. I can't even believe it. And it's what I'm going through right now. Mm-hmm. I've been working on sobriety, trying to be ever present for a little while through AA, but having found this has just changed everything. And I feel like I'm just, you know, I'm just thinking, I'm no longer just treading water, you know, where I had been. But it's just, you're expanding. This is a possible, this is giving me a lot. But just back to these three P's, because of my perfectionism, right? And it leads to procrastination and then being paralyzed. That's exactly what's happening to me right now. For the past couple of months, I had the intention, like, maybe I'll start organizing my finances. You know, during COVID, I had some extra time and I thought, you know, I need to address this. I need to, but I've gotten to the point like, oh, I just hate it. I don't want to face it. I don't want to look at it. And so then I've been putting it off. And I am literally right now paralyzed because I don't even know where to begin anymore. I don't even, what? So what can I do to get me out of this paralyzed state of just this you know, it might be going on in other areas, but I know I can see it very clearly in this.
Well, I'm, you know, it's interesting because someone just put something in chat, which is exactly what I was thinking about, which is this is very much like what happens with creative people, with writers especially. They get like, oh, it's the blank page, like, and they, you know, they have an idea for a book, but it's like you can't start because it's like you need the whole book there, or similarly, you know, you write something like when I was in grad school in creative writing, people would come in with the first chapter of their book and they would share it with us and we'd workshop it. And then the next time they came up for workshop, they'd be with the first chapter of their book again, and they would be have completely rewritten it. And the professor, who was, you know, a noted novelist, was like, just keep going. Don't keep rewriting the first chapter. So, you know, in terms of, I think in a situation like what you're describing, I think it's, and well, I'll say that one of the strategies for getting work done as a creative person is to not measure your accomplishment by how good it is, but just how many words you wrote or that you put in so many hours at it. So I would think just set aside an hour and do whatever you can do. Set like a certain amount of time each day, and then you're done for the day. And just each day, put in that hour or whatever it is. And okay, once that's done, then you're off the hook. You don't have to feel bad. It's, you know, and because one thing is for sure, if you devote a certain amount of time to a project consistently, eventually it will get done. And that's one of the things, I mean, my sponsor, that was one of the things he taught me early on. And it was like very, again, like it was like job hunting. Just apply for, you know, one job each day or whatever it was. And that way I didn't get caught up in this feeling like, oh God, I haven't got a job. It's like, no, this just persistence. It's that water on rock, you know, you just keep doing it and it'll get done. You know?
I thank you. I know that I've just built it up in my head to be so much larger than it is. And, you know, I apply that to that, those steps, you know, just do a little at a time to so many other things. But I think maybe that I just admitted it out loud is big right there.
Yeah.
You know, so anyway, thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks, Michelle. Jimmy.
Hey, Kevin. Yeah, it's amazing how, it's completely how I'm experiencing things right now. The perfectionism, you know, and the paralysis, you know, at least when I was drinking, I was getting shit done, although it sucked. You know, I mean, it was half-assed and, you know, and I know I could do, I've done a lot better sober, but it's not consistent. I mean, sometimes I get stuck in that paralysis state. And but anyways, this really hits home for me too, you know. And I really like that, just the water on the rock, just keep hitting it, keep hitting it, keep hitting it, and you know, eventually it'll, you know, crack through.
Yeah.
And so anyways, thanks for your talk.
Yeah, thanks Jimmy. Nice. Well, for a very small part of the book, seems to be something that resonates for a lot of people, you know, because I was looking at it like, oh, this is this funny little thing that my sponsor taught me like 35 years ago. Like, and I don't think about it much anymore because I guess I do think that I apply those principles to my life now. And so it's a little odd to go back and look at it in that version. But yeah, maybe, oh, there's one more. Angela, you were going to say something?
Yeah, I just thought I might as well, since it's just funny, I was talking about this before we got started in class, because I read, this has been big for me, you know, perfectionism. And yeah, I really appreciated the way that you just reminded me too of, well, yeah, and a lot of it's, I guess, fear too, and not trusting myself, you know, when it comes to, I made so many, and again, it's like, I don't know, the more that I think about it, I guess, yeah, I made so many bad decisions, you know, and don't really trust me. And then the indecision has always been an issue for me, and fear of, you know, making the wrong choice or hurting others, you know, just a lot of stuff that I, you know, kind of swirls around. The meditation today was also really, really helpful. And I experienced that with meditation. You know, I think that's a big reason why it was so hard for me to get a daily practice going, because it was so, you know, it was just, I didn't really get relief when I sat, you know, cause it was just, and that misconception that, you know, I'm not doing it good enough for, just remembering my retreat with you, you know, in 2019, it's just like, yeah, constant thoughts, just, and you're just looking at me like, yeah, well, it's okay, you know, in our, you know, meetings. But, quickly about the procrastination, it's just interesting because I was talking about this article that I read from National Geographic about like procrastination and the pandemic, and also this kind of phenomenon of, you know, procrastinating by doing things that are still like useful, you know, like I love to organize and clean. And so instead of like doing my work, I'm, you know, going off and organizing things that I don't really need to, it's like the, you know, you're still putting off the important thing basically that you need to do, but it seems like less harmful because, you know, you're doing something that is worthwhile. Or like for me, you know, actually in your interview with Dan Harris about, you know, doing too much of a good thing, or like for me, you know, starting to really take on more kind of commitments, or like get this, I don't know, just not like keeping balanced, you know, cause I'm talking about it in therapy, and I have lots of resources, a coach, you know, for kind of the way to work. But I guess I'm saying all this cause I don't know if it would be helpful for others to hear, and just what you, I think mindfulness obviously, and just awareness, and but yeah, it's so interesting how I can try that idea of effort as well, of like, you know, is it just really about just doing the thing and not like investigating, like, why do I have so much resistance? Like I, you know, show up to a meeting with a coach every 2 weeks, and it's like really clear that, yeah, of course it's harder to do the work, you know, it just, I don't know why, but does it really matter why? Just that idea of, do we just, yeah, do the thing? But it's hard to not look at like what's keeping me from, you know, doing what I need to do for, you know, for my work. So I don't know if any of that's making sense, but.
Yeah. You know, I don't know if this applies to you, but I think that the, you know, part of maybe the, what perfectionism is really about is about ego. And, you know, our self image, and we can't, accept being less than perfect. And so that procrastination paralysis formula, you'd rather do nothing than do something imperfectly, because if you do nothing, then, you know, you didn't fail or you didn't come up short, you know. And sort of that acceptance of imperfection, you know, that book, The Spirituality of Imperfection. And that book opens with the talking about baseball, you know, about how the best hitters in the world fail 2/3 of the time. And I mean, can you imagine having to maintain your emotional balance when you fail most of the time, you know, and you fail in front of 50,000 people or maybe millions that are watching you on television? Like, wow, like that's a great lesson to me. Of course, golf is equally educational in that way. I was going to go, but Sherry, you are welcome to say something.
Yeah, I was just going to make a quick comment. I think it's Hopi Indians. The women, when they're doing their bead work or their clay work or anything, they always made sure that they made a mistake on purpose to keep that sense of humility.
Yeah. Yeah, beautiful. Which is right similar to the, at least what, you know, the sort of about Japanese art, that there's something in that too, that yeah. Yeah. So let's all fail today. Let's do our best to fail and just enjoy it, right? No, I mean, yeah. Why do we first of all, like, set up these ideas of what we should be, and then make ourselves miserable because we can't be them? You know, that's just like, wow. You know, life isn't hard enough, but now I'm gonna make it harder by setting impossible standards for myself. Sounds great. Thanks. Well, on that happy note, so I'm going to have to start working on step 8 because we're almost in step 8. So I have to get ahead. I have to stay ahead of the crowd here for you guys. Catch up with me. So thank you. And I got some nice Donna recently. So I want to thank everybody who's been supporting me for this year. When I started doing this, I didn't have an idea of how long it was going to last, but I think, like, in the back of my mind, I was thinking, okay, it's March, you know, maybe we'll do this until like the summer, you know. So here we are in year 2. So take care, be well, stay safe, and yeah, and peaceful. Well, thank you.